Very cool. I love that story. And I love Mark too. Him and his wife are become good friends of ours, and he's a mean bumper boats player. Went to the New Jersey State Fair this week. Took me out. My name is Anthony, for those of you who don't know me, and I'm excited to continue this series that we are in, and I just hope you all had a nice 4th of July weekend. I want to thank all of those who came out to our 4th of July picnic at Maxwell. We had a really, really great time sweating, and that's what this season is all about. And summer's slowly starting to make its way back up in my rank of seasons. When we're a kid, we love summer, right? We love summer because we can get it off. We don't have to go to school. But slowly, as I got older, I tend to favor the colder months a little bit more. And fall kind of still takes its number one place. But now I think summer's is a close second. I mean, I love going to beaches. I love barbecues. One of the main reasons I love summer is baseball. And I'm a huge baseball nerd. I grew up in Colorado, and in 1993, my life was forever changed when the Colorado Rockies came into play. They're a real Major League Baseball team, for those of you who don't know. They are my team now. Not too many people know about them because they don't really do much. They're not that great of a team. 2007 was the only year we've ever been to the World Series, and those were like the glory days. You know, we all sit around and go, oh, remember 2007? But you know, they're in a slump, right? They've been in a slump for decades, and I still love those little buggers, and as much as they frustrate me to no end, they're in a slump. You know, they have nobody in the Baseball Hall of Fame, coaches or players. They're just, you know, they're just kind of there, frustrating me. And we know what slumps are, right? I mean, you Mets fans and Cubs fans, you know what slumps are like, right? I know you're doing well now, hush. But I'm just saying, you know what it's like for teams to be in slumps. And I looked up the definition of slumps because it's something to know. It says, a slump is to fall heavily or to undergo a severe or prolonged fall. That's definitely the story of the Colorado Rockies. There's a lot of ways that we can slip into a slump. We can be at slumps at work, you know. We could be at slumps at school. We can be in slumps in a relationship. I mean, slumps, you know, just kind of being there. You're not really moving forward. Sometimes you're moving back. You're just kind of existing. I used to work in higher education, and I remember something they used to call the sophomore slump, right? It happens in high school, it happens in college, but it's that feeling you get when you become a sophomore. You know, when you're a freshman, everybody dotes on you, and they're so excited, and they're like, oh, he's a freshman, look how cute, and they walk you through, and they, you know, there's all these great things. You're at a new campus, you got new friends, new school, and then you become a sophomore, and people are like, who cares? You know, you're not really an upperclassman, you're no longer the cute freshman, you're just kind of existing, you're just kind of there. And that's kind of what it means to be in a slump. And I think if we think about it in life, there's a lot of different types of slumps. I came into this relationship with Christ when I was in graduate school, and when I say come into this relationship, or when I say, you know, walking into this relationship with Christ, it basically means that I trusted that God is who He says that He is. I trust that He said He sent His Son to die for my sins, and I trusted in that night. And I remember it was in August of 2005 when I was in graduate school, and I remember being in my apartment. I was in graduate school in Alabama, and I remember being in my apartment in Alabama, and I just had this great experience. I had this you know, kind of like what Mark was talking about with his wife, you know, that she just had this experience of who God was and changed her life. And that night he changed my life. You know, I remember listening to a television preacher, believe it or not, talk to me about grace, and it changed my life. And it was really that night that I walked into this relationship, that I trusted God. And I remember I didn't know who to call, I didn't know who to tell, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and so I called my dad who was at home in Colorado, and he had kind of walked into this relationship, rededicated his life to God when I was in high school, and so we were talking about it that night, and I'm like, what do I do? And he's like, well, we got to get you a good Bible, and we got to get you into a good church. And that day, that next day, I went and I found a great church, and I jumped in, I dived in, I went full throttle. I signed up to volunteer. Before you know it, I was serving in the kids ministry. I was in a Bible study. I was in a small group. Like I was, as my dad put it, I was on fire. And I can actually remember the feeling of like getting excited to open up my Bible, because I was like, this makes sense. I'm starting to understand this. For the first time in my life, this is cool. I'm getting excited about this. And this happened for about 3 months. I was so passionate about God, and I was so excited, and I was very new, and I was learning all of these things about who God said I am, and the things that I was working through, and just I was just so, so on fire. And then about 3 months after this, I remember I was home in my apartment in Alabama, and I was watching television, and a suggestive ad came on the television. And I don't need to go into details, but it was suggestive. And one of my struggles in the past, before I came to now, I'll be perfectly honest, was lust. I wasn't always the best guy. In fact, I tend to be very visual when it came to how I looked at women. And throughout high school and college, I was just visual. I didn't really care about how they were or who they were, just as long as they looked pretty. In fact, in college, they used to say, well, Anthony likes his pretty things. And I'm just being honest with you. I wasn't proud about it. I'm still not proud about it, but this is who I was. And it caused me to go into a life of lust and pornography. And about 3 months after, like I said, 3 months of being on fire for God and 3 months completely avoiding anything that I thought was bad, that one suggestive ad led me into a slump. The slump of just repetitive behavior. And sometimes I'd go a couple of days, sometimes I'd go a few weeks, sometimes I'd go a few months. And I would always go right back into it, right back into my slump. And I remember after a while calling my dad and confessing to him what had been going on, and I was just so upset. And I just remember going, God, Dad, I was so on fire. I was so excited about what God was doing in my life. And I loved being near him, and I loved learning from him, and I just loved being with him. And aren't we always on fire for him? And I remember my dad that night, I remember exactly what he said. He said, oh, son, I wish that was the truth. But no. Sometimes we walk into these slumps. Sometimes these slumps happen in our lives spiritually. And listen, some of you here today are listening to this, and maybe you're not in that kind of a slump, but maybe you are in a different type of a slump. Maybe you've been going through the motions, and you've been, yeah, we're still coming to church, and we're still, you know, maybe you're even still serving or going to dinner group, but I'm just not feeling it. You know, maybe we're in a slump relationship-wise, or personally with our significant other, or maybe you're here today and somebody's dragged you here, or somebody's invited you to come, and you're really not sure how you feel about this whole God thing, and or maybe you showed up because something's tugging at your heart, and you know what it means to be in a slump, both physically and spiritually, and there's just times when God just seems, he just seems distant. It's usually not right away. I mean, it's kind of like a tire with a hole in it. Sometimes it just kind of starts to become flat, you know. Maybe you stepped back from dinner group, or you stepped back from serving on a team, and you're just kind of there in a slump. And it becomes this fight. It becomes this struggle. And that's really one of the reasons we're calling this series The Fight. And we're in week four. And I want to encourage you, if this is your first time with us, to go back and to listen to the podcasts from the first 3 weeks or watch the live stream. And a shout out to those who are watching and listening that way right now. Because we've been walking through some really cool things, but we've been looking at the life of this guy named Jacob. And the reason we call it The Fight is because his entire life was a fight. His entire life, he was fighting with other people, he was fighting with God, he was fighting with himself. It was always a struggle with him. And the reason he plays such a significant role is that if you look, his story is told in the book of Genesis, which is the first book of, as you look into the Bible, the first book there, and it's the whole book of Genesis is 50 chapters, and 25 of it spans the life of Jacob. And there's so many times where you see him struggling, and so many times where you see him fighting, and there's so many times you see him in these type of slumps. So I'm going to do a little recap before we continue today's story of how we're working through the life of Jacob. What do we know about Jacob? We know that he is a deceiver. We know that he's a liar. We know that he's a manipulator. We know that he's a terrible son who lied to his blind father on his deathbed. We know that he's an awful brother who stole the birthright from his and blessing from his brother. To say that Jacob's in a slump is kind of an understatement. He's pretty much in a disaster at this point, and we look at it and we see that there's some significant moments along the way. He goes away for 20 years, right? He steals the birthright from his brother Esau, and he runs away because Esau threatens to kill him. And after 20 years, he kind of starts to build his life. He has this incredible experience with God. He actually literally comes face to face with God. He fights God physically, and God changes his name. He changes his name from Jacob the Deceiver, which means deceiver, to Israel, which means triumphant with God. So he has this incredible experience. He decides, now that I'm reconciled with God, I've got to reconcile with other people. So last week we looked at how he reconciled with his brother Esau. After 20 years, they hadn't seen each other. The last time they saw each other, Esau wanted to kill him. And what happens? They come back together, and there's this glorious, triumphant scene of reconciliation where the brothers are hugging. Everything is forgotten. Everything is water under the bridge. They're introducing each other to their family. This is Uncle Esau. Oh my goodness. Everybody's so happy and everybody's so excited, and it seems like everything is going great. But then we get to this crossroads in Jacob's life. So, just so you know, put yourself in that. He's just wrestled with God. He's changed. He's got a limp that'll forever remember that interaction with him, that wrestling with God. He's just reconciled with Esau. We're in Genesis chapter 33, and just after they reconcile, this is what happens. Verse 12. Well, Esau said, let's be going. I'll lead the way. But Jacob replied, well, you can see, my lord, that some of my children are very young, and the flocks and herds have their young too. If they're driven too hard, even for one day, all the animals could die. Please, my lord, go ahead of your servant. We will follow slowly at a pace that is comfortable for the livestock and the children, and I will meet you at Seir. All right, Esau said, but at least let me sign some of my men to guide and protect you. Jacob responded, well, that's not necessary. It's enough that you've received me warmly, my lord. So Esau turned around and started back to Seir that same day. Jacob, on the other hand, traveled on to Succoth. There he built himself a house and made shelters for his livestock. That is why the place was named Succoth, which means shelters. First of all, what a terrible name. Where are you from, Succoth? What did you say to me? But this is what I love about this passage. And it's so interesting to me. He goes in the opposite direction. He has this interaction with his brother that he's just reconciled with, right? And Esau's like, let's go. Come on, bro. Let's be a family. Let's go. We'll settle. We'll be neighbors. You know, your kids will play with my kids. It'll be great. And Jacob's like, you know, you go ahead. I'm going to join you. I'm going to come a little bit. I'm going to join you. I got some slow people, but I'm going to join you. And then he goes in the opposite direction. Some of you have done that in life. Yeah, I'll go to your party, yeah. Let's go. But that's what he does. Jacob goes right back into his old self. Jacob goes right back into being a liar. He knows he's not going to see her. He's going to Succoth. So he goes. He goes in the opposite direction. He lies to Esau. And you know what's interesting about this passage? Go back to the beginning of this where it says, well, Esau said, let's be going. I will lead the way. But Jacob replied. If you remember in Genesis chapter 32, God changed his name from Jacob, which means liar, to Israel, which means triumphant with God. And God, we talked about this in week two, that God does this a lot. God likes to change people's names. He likes to change people's identity. Early, his grandfather, Jacob's grandfather, is a guy named Abraham, right? He went from changing his name Abram, God changed his name from Abram to Abraham, right? And interestingly enough, the writer of the book of Genesis, who is Moses, all right, Red Sea guy, all right, Ten Commandments dude, Charlton Heston, he wrote the book of Genesis and changed his name as soon as changed Abraham's name as soon as God changed it. If you look at the scriptures, when as soon as God changes his name from Abram to Abraham, Moses changes his name as he continues to write the book of Genesis. He calls him Abraham. But interestingly enough, in Jacob's instance, he doesn't. God changes his name from Jacob to Israel, but Moses continues to write Jacob. Because Jacob's still a deceiver. He's still living up to his own ways. And the importance about going to Succoth is actually twofold. Not only is he lying to his brother, but number two is he's not going to where God wanted him to go. He's not showing up where God wanted him to be. In fact, 20 years earlier at this point, God told him to go to Bethel. Bethel is where God originally, in a dream, showed up to Jacob and said, you will return here to build an altar for me. Bethel and Seir are in, Bethel and Succoth are in opposite directions. So not only is Jacob lying to his brother, but he's also not going to where God wanted him to go. It's much like Mark's story when he said that, you know, there are times in his life when God gave him a crossroads. You can either go here or you can either go here. Jacob decided that he knew what was better. He knew where he needed to go. He knew that he needed to continue his journey, so he does. And it says this in verse 18. It says, later, having traveled all the way to Paddan Aram, Jacob arrived safely at the town of Shechem in the land of Canaan. There he set up camp outside the town. Jacob bought the plot of land where he camped from the family of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver. And there he built an altar, and he named it El Elohe Israel, which means the God of Israel. So he stops short of returning to Bethel, lies to his brother, but it's not like he forgot God altogether. At least he built an altar, right? He kind of met God halfway there. He didn't abandon God completely, but Jacob still settled short of the place that God wanted him to be. And yeah, he was going through the outward motions and he was doing what needed to be done, but it's almost as if this incredible experience that he had in Bethel, this incredible experience that he had in Peniel, where he heard God both times, he came face to face with God, and then it just kind of fell back. He kind of forgot about that. And then for the next 10 years, he comes across some of the worst things that will ever happen to him. And you thought it was bad before. You thought he was a liar, deceiver, and all that stuff. Read chapter 34. I'm not going to go through it verse for verse, but if you're a Game of Thrones fan, check out Genesis chapter 34. Something awful happens to his daughter, and his sons kill an entire city full of dudes. It's an awful story. Like I said, to say that Jacob's in a slump is an understatement. This is a disaster. And some of us get to this point in the story, and you're reading through this, and maybe you're the way that I was. When I first came across the story, I was like, are you sure this is the guy? God, is this is the guy you want to use? I fully expected at this point, after reading chapter 34, the beginning of chapter 35, to be like, okay, Jacob, that's it, we're done. You have screwed up one too many times. I'm gonna choose another group of people to be my covenant people. All right, you're clearly not ready for this. And to tell you the truth, guys, it is exactly how I felt for a number of years. When I was constantly falling back into this cycle of just falling and and looking at things that I was not supposed to be looking at. I kept thinking to myself, when is God going to be done with me? When is this going to be too much for God? When is God just going to be like, sorry, Anthony, you blew it? I used to think that God was angry at me. He was disappointed in me. I used to keep saying, how could I believe that God is who he says he is and God does what he says he's going to do and I'm doing this? I should know better. I should know better. What's interesting, though, is what happens next. The beginning of chapter 35 in Genesis should give all of us who struggle with that a little bit of hope. Because God responds to him after all of this terrible thing, after awful things happen to his daughter, and after his sons have basically killed an entire group of people. Genesis 35:1 says this, "Then God said to Jacob, 'Get ready and move to Bethel and settle there. Build an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau.'" And here's what's crazy about this moment right here. 10 years prior to this, okay? 10 years prior to this moment, a decade before God spoke to Jacob in a dream, you know what happened? This is what he said. This is Genesis 31:13. This is a decade earlier. "I am the God who appeared to you at Bethel, the place where you anointed the pillar of stone and made your vow to me. Now get ready to leave this country and return." God said this to Jacob 10 years earlier. "Jacob, go to Bethel." But Jacob decided 10 years ago that he was going to do his own thing, that he thought, you know what, I know a little bit better than God, so I'm going to do what I wanted to do. And 10 years after that, God comes back to speaking to Jacob again, and he says, what? "Jacob, go to Bethel. Okay, bud? You ready to try things my way now? You ready to do what I told you to do? Dude, just go to Bethel." And as much as we try to fight this, as much as we try to think that, you know what, maybe we do know what's better for our lives, the truth is that God does know what's better for us. But just like Jacob, God keeps calling us back, even after a decade of being in this slump. God comes back to Jacob and says, "Hey, buddy, you ready for me yet? You ready to listen to me?" And in this moment of clarity, Jacob kind of wakes up a little bit. And this is what happens in verse 2. He says, "So Jacob told everyone in his household, 'Get rid of all your pagan idols. Purify yourselves and put on clean clothing. We're now going to Bethel, where I will build an altar to God who answered my prayers when I was in distress. He has been with me wherever I've gone.' So they gave Jacob all their pagan idols and earrings and buried them under the great tree near Shechem." God once again speaks to Jacob, despite of his sin, despite of his rebellion, despite of him being a bonehead. God responds to him, and Jacob says, "You know what? Something's not right." And once we realized what he needed to do, he needed to go back to God. It was almost as if he came to his senses. And God didn't have to tell him that this is what he needed to do. He came to his household and said, "All right, guys, made some mistakes, but this is what we got to do. We're going to Bethel. We're going to where God told me to go. You need to give me all those things you've been worshiping. You need to give me those other foreign god statues that you've been giving. And apparently there's something wrong with the earrings too, so take those earrings off." Take them off. We're going to bury them. Now you may be thinking to yourself, well, I don't have any, you know, little statues, but maybe I do have earrings. I'm not saying you have to get rid of your earrings, okay? What I am saying here is that what an idol is, and an idol is this. This is an idol. This is what the definition is. An idol is anything that takes the place of God in your life and blocks you from growing and understanding what God's will is. For some, it's the idol of career success, right? We're going to do everything that we can. Everything else, even the family, is subordinate to that. For others, it's affluence and collecting all the things that others people say that we need in order to make us happy. Sometimes it's just personal fulfillment. I want to do what makes me happy. Sometimes it's just a life of leisure, you know? Oh, you know, I don't really have time for dinner group, or I don't really have time for serve. I got to enjoy myself. And it's interesting. We heard it in Mark's story, but it's even in my story that the idol that we really have to get rid of is ourself in these manifestations. Jacob comes to this moment of clarity. He's coming to his senses, and he goes, I have just endured. I've put my family into all of this pointless pain because of my disobedience. And this light bulb goes off, and he's like, man, I've been an idiot. This is exactly what happened to me. This is exactly what happened to me. I remember after the umpteenth time of falling and going to God and literally saying, God, don't forget about me. Don't weep for me. I literally had this moment of saying, all right, that's it. That's it. Enough is enough. I got to stop this. And I made some drastic measures. I took some drastic measures in my fight against lust and pornography in my life. Number one, I got rid of my smartphone. I went back to a flip phone. You can't do much on a flip phone, let alone access the internet. Number two, you know what else I got rid of? My high-speed internet. I went back to dial-up. Let me tell you something. It takes 20 minutes to download one picture. You start to think about what you're doing. I also signed up for, I put filtering software on my computer. I went to an accountability, I got into an accountability group. All right, it's a bunch of men that we sit together and we talk about this. In fact, I got into an accountability group. I'm still in an accountability group to this day. I even put on accountability software on my computer, which means every page that happens, every page that's being sent that I visit on my computer, every page goes to my pastor and my father. I was like, look at how many times I'm going to Bible Gateway. See? See? I cleaned house. Just like Jacob did. It was time to clean house. Where is God calling you to clean house today? Is God calling you, any of you, to just draw the line in the sand and say, not anymore. Today's the day. Is this your Gandalf moment? You shall not pass. This is that moment. So they leave for Bethel, right? He brushes off. He says, enough is enough. We're good. We're good. We're going to go back to where God is finally. I'm going to stop ignoring God. I'm going to stop being disobedient to him. We're going to get rid of all the things that distract us from God, and we're going to go to where God told me to go. And so he picks up his family. He says, enough is enough. In Genesis 35, 6 through 8, it says this. Eventually, Jacob and his household arrive at Luz. Whatever. Also called Bethel in Canaan. He's finally arrived in Bethel after 30 years because God had appeared to him there when he was fleeing from his brother Esau. Soon after this, Rebekah's old nurse Deborah died. She was buried beneath the oak tree in the valley below Bethel. Ever since, the tree has been called Allon-Bacuth, which means the oak of weeping. He's done it. He's gone back to Bethel. He's done what God asked him to do. He's cleaned house and everything's back on track. Then out of nowhere, there's this weird verse 8, that says, soon after this, Rebekah's old nurse, Deborah, had died. It seems to come out of nowhere. But the interesting thing enough about this, if we go back and we remember who Rebekah is his mother. Rebekah is Jacob's mother. And if her nurse has died, that means Rebekah's died too. It's actually an awfully sad verse because he missed it. He's been away for 30 years. And he never got a chance to say goodbye to his mom because of his own rebellion. Because of his own disobedience that kept him away so long, he missed saying goodbye to his mom. Listen, God never leaves us. God never left me. While I was struggling, God doesn't leave us when we're struggling. God didn't leave Jacob, but I'll tell you one thing. We do have to deal with the consequences of our own disobedience. But there is hope. There is hope because as you see, as it continues in verse 9, it says, now that Jacob had returned from Padan Aram, God appeared to him again at Bethel. God blessed him, saying, your name is Jacob. But you will not be called Jacob any longer. From now on, your name will be Israel. So God renamed him Israel. Well, that sounds familiar. That's interesting. I mean, if you've been working with us through the fight, or if you know the story, it's the exact same thing that God said to him in chapter 32. just after he got done wrestling with him. In fact, here it is, Genesis 32, 28. "Your name will no longer be Jacob," the man told him. "From now on, you will be called Israel, because you have fought with God and with men and have won." For the past 10 years of Jacob's life, Jacob has been passive. He's been lukewarm. He's been disobedient. He's been consumed with himself. He's been distracted from God. And now God is saying, "Hey, look at me. Just so you know, I'm not done with you yet. I know you've been dumb. I know you've ignored me. I know you've been a terrible husband. You've been an awful father. But you have to remember something. I changed your name. I'm not finished with you yet. Get back on this horse and let's continue to do this, because I'm not done with you yet." And what's interesting here is actually in the passage, it's the first time that God spoke to Jacob was at Bethel, was at the dream of Bethel. Now, after 30 years of coming back to this, God is bringing him back to the first place that God spoke to him, which is at Bethel. God keeps bringing him back. He keeps reminding him who he is. Every week we say this in silence. It doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter where you've been. It doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter what you are doing. God is pursuing you. And you may think that you have done something big, screwed up big time, that you may think that God wants nothing to do with you. You may think that you've screwed up one too many times for God to give a crap about you. I'm here to tell you that if you're listening to this, whether in person, on live stream, or on the podcast, God is not done pursuing you yet. He's not done with you. God says, "This is who you are." He doesn't remind him of his past failures. He doesn't remind him of all the things that he's done. He looks forward. He says, "You're Israel, one who is triumphant with God." He keeps reminding him who he is. This is proof that God is the God of second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth chances. He continues to show up and give chance after chance. "Yeah, I've screwed up. And yes, you've screwed up. We've all been disobedient. We've all screwed up. We haven't kept God at the forefront of our mind. He hasn't been the first thing that we've been trying to please. We've all done it before. But just like Jacob, we've gotten sidetracked. We've allowed compromise to come into our lives. But God remains faithful even when we are faithless." It says this in 2 Timothy 2:13. It says, "If we're unfaithful, he remains faithful because he cannot deny who he is. When you fall on your face, God is saying, get up, dust yourself off, and let's go. Let's keep walking." That's why sometimes this is called a walk. Your walk with God, your walk with Christ. When you walk with somebody, you're side by side. And when you screw up, when you fall, God's there to pick you up. He says this, Galatians 5:7, "You were running the race so well. Who's held you back from following the truth?" Pastor Chris introduced this verse in week one of our series, and I think it's a great, series verse. It says, "I've fought the good fight, I've finished the race, and I have remained faithful, and now the prize awaits me, the crown of righteousness which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on the day of his return. And the prize is not just for me, but all who eagerly look forward to his appearing." We got to run this race. And yeah, sometimes in our race of life, we're going to fall. I started running in October, all right, believe it or not. And since then, I've finished 17 5Ks, 5 10Ks, and one half marathon. Thank you very much. And let me tell you something. That first 5K I ever did, my first 5K, about 2 seconds out of the gate, I fell on my face. And I didn't just go, oops, I went down. I kissed the floor. Of course, I tried to cover it up a little bit, and I was like, I'm just doing a push-up. But no, it hurt. I skinned my knee. I scraped my hands. Like, I was done. And of course, it was by the starting line, and so everyone was like, ew. And I was like, I'm okay. I'm all right. And I kept going. And that was the first race. And since then, I've continued to keep going. And yeah, sometimes I stumble. Yeah, sometimes I fall. But it's all about this. And that's what life is going to bring us. We're going to fall. We're going to fall short. We're going to do this. We're going to screw up. But God continues to come back to us. He continues to bring us back to that moment that he first spoke to us, that he said, this is what I want you to do. This is who I want you to be. And this is really cool. This is what ends up happening. Verse 11, as we continue the story, Then God said, I am El Shaddai, which means God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. You will become a great nation, even many nations. Kings will be among your descendants, and I will give you the land I once gave to Abraham and Isaac. Yes, I will give it to you and your descendants. This is awesome. I mean, he basically reaffirms his promise. And listen, here's the truth. Jacob is shown this amazing grace, which, mind you, he has done nothing to deserve. But God continues to show him this amazing grace. And that's what we believe. We believe that our salvation is by grace through faith. There is nothing that we can do, nothing that we can do apart from putting our trust in Jesus Christ that gives us this gift of salvation. There's nothing that works that we can do. There's nothing how good we can be, quote unquote. But how does Jacob respond? That's the amazing thing about it. When we are lavished upon this grace, when we realize all the things that God has done for us, Jacob has this moment where he realizes all the things that God has done. He's kept him safe. He's wrestled with him. He's changed his name. He's changed his identity. He's got this huge family now. He's been blessed with great wealth. He realizes all the cool things that he's got and all the things that he's thankful for. And this is how he responds. Genesis 35:13, it says, then God went up from the place where he had spoken to Jacob. Jacob set up a stone pillar to mark the place where God had spoken to him. Then he poured wine over it as an offering to God and anointed the pillar with olive oil. And Jacob named the place Bethel, which means house of God, because God had spoken to him there. This is what I love. Then he poured wine over it as an offering to God. He poured one out for his homie. He poured one out for God. And he did this as a moment to remember him by. God, this is for you. This is what you did for me. And you laugh about it, but it's true. This is what he did. He responded to God by giving him an offering, by offering of himself, by offering of what he had. And interestingly enough, this is the first time a drink offering is mentioned in the Bible at all. And the Apostle Paul uses this type of offering as an analogy for his own life. He says this in Philippians chapter 2. He says, but I will rejoice even if I lose my life, pouring it out like a liquid offering to God. Just like your faithful service is an offering to God. And I want all of you to share that joy. Yes, you should rejoice, and I will share your joy. Paul said he wanted his life to be like a drink offering to the Lord. Yes, like I said, it's true. Nothing we can do can earn our salvation. But there are things that we can do to remind us who we are and what God has called us to do. How do baseball teams get out of slumps? They practice. They don't just stop playing, even though some of them should. Sometimes we think we need to learn some new spiritual truth, or we need to learn something that's just going to mind blow us to be able to get back on this horse, right? Usually all we need to be is reminded of the old truths that we already know. We have to remember what God has done for us and what he's continuing to do for us. God reminded Jacob of the promises he gave years before. And as Jacob knelt there before God at Bethel, he wasn't alone this time. He had his entire family around with him. And he's looking around and he is remembering and thanking God for what he's got to get out of this slump. Behind each, Pastor Chris talked about it earlier, but all of our tables around here, we have something that we do every Sunday. It's called the Lord's Supper or communion. And literally in the verse, when Christ tells us to observe the Lord's Supper, he tells us to, first he gives thanks, he breaks bread and he gives thanks. That's the first thing he does. And then he asks us to do this in remembrance of him. To do this as remembers. God is always calling his people back. He's always calling his people to come home. That's what we're here for. That's our mission, to help people find their way back to God, to help people come home to God. Everything we do is an opportunity to respond to that. And that's what I want to encourage you all to do today. Each week, we've been giving you something to practice, right? Because we call this series The Fight. When you're in a fight, when you're training, CKO, kickboxing, whatever, you got to train, you got to practice, right? So week one, we told you to fast. Week two, we told you to go to God and ask you, God, who do you say that I am? Week three, last week, we talked about reconciliation. I asked you to go to that person that you need to be reconciled, or maybe it was God that you needed to be reconciled to. Today, I'm asking you to respond. Respond the same way that Jacob did. When he realized all the things that God had done, that he had never forgotten him, that even though that he screwed up time and time and time again, he never forgot the one who was always pursuing him. So So I'm going to encourage you during this next song when the band comes up to respond. Respond with the words, respond right in your seat in prayer, and go. If you already haven't, go. Take communion, give thanks, break that bed. Remember just how far he's came to pursue you. And this is the truth. I am so glad that God hasn't given up on me, even though he has every right to. And I am so glad that God hasn't given up on you, even though he has every right to. God knows you. He knows everything about you. He knows you're good. He knows you're bad. He knows all those secrets you don't want to tell anybody. And you know what? Despite all of that, he says, I want to use you. Will you pray with me? Father, we don't understand this. I guess that's why it's called Amazing Grace, because it is amazing. We don't deserve it. We deserve far worse than what you have for us. But because of your love, because of what you've done for us by sending your son to die for us on the cross, you have given us so much. Help us to remember that. That despite of our shortcomings, despite of how we screw up, despite of us wavering, that you never waver. That you never leave us. That despite us running from you, you never leave us. You're always pursuing us. So I invite us to run towards you, to respond to you, because you are the God who never wavers. Thank you. And it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.